This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading this. I'm Mark Stephen. We are building the podcasts at the moment out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. This week, very much a birdie theme.
Hello and a very good morning to you. I'm Mark Stephen, and with me once again this morning, Mr. Ewan McElraith. There's a very definite autumnal feel to the air now, and by a definite autumnal feel, what I really mean is big lumps of water. Boy, it's damp this morning.
Yeah, there's a yellow warning for rain for most of the country, Saturday into Sunday, Central Belt, Tayside, Fife and Grampian. The monsoon has just stopped. I was wondering this morning, can I actually broadcast this? I'm underneath what's lovingly called a sun parasol, which was keeping the rain off, but it was bucketing down. As usual, we're always keen to hear from you. Let us know what you're up to in the rain. Out of doors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295. You can call as well, 08085 92 95 00. Lewis has braved the rain with a rather natty umbrella, and he's there to take your calls.
I'm kind of stuck here at the moment. I must confess, you know, there's a bit of a sort of glass... Well, there is a bit of a glass roof just in front of the building in BBC Aberdeen. If I shelter under that, I can stay out of the rain. But if I do that, then the smoke from the fire and the sparks are getting me. I don't know what to do.
People just do not appreciate the dilemmas we have every morning
in
terms
of
bringing this programme every week.
Absolutely. No idea how difficult this job is. They don't care either. Last week, I had a fabulous time. I walked the West Highland Way in its 40th year. I have to say, with the exception of a couple of really long days, and then it was just like the hour at the end, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and you'll be able to hear how we go on in programme next week.
Yeah, I did it a couple of years back, and it is just fantastic. I kind of broke down and cried on the east side of Loch Lomond for a wee while, but after that, it just got better and better, and you just felt your spirit soar. One section going across Rannoch Moor in the bucketing rain and midges, kind of a low point for me. But we've got another adventure for you this week, though. We've got a couple of weeks ago. You and I went to take a trip. We wanted to do this for ages, and you've been desperate to do it. Went out to the Bass Rock off North Berwick to visit the biggest northern gannetry colony in the world. And, you know, David Attenborough said it is one of the wildlife sites, the best wildlife sites in the world. And I'm with David.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, actually. I mean, that's going to be coming up shortly. Years we've been waiting to actually do this. And we got out there with Maggie Shedden, she's the queen of the bass, frankly. First, however, let's have a listen to this week's mystery bird.
Yeah, kind of birdtastic this week. It was almost like the Bass Rock. You and I were very guilty of dropping, when we were in St Kilda, into conversations. Now I've started to say, we were on the Bass Rock. Anyway, really special bird. It's coexisted with man for thousands of years, and one which we kind of nearly killed off. It's almost top in every world record, and it's one which it's claimed, I'm claiming it, gave birth to the green movement of today. Okay, any ideas what that might be? email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can tweet 8029, text 80295, or give Lewis a ring, 08085 92 95 00. If you think you know what that is, I'm kind of sneaking feeling this may be too easy.
I must confess, it's quite. I think it's quite. It's an ear-catching one, that, and it's one I would have identified immediately, but purely and simply because it's something that I've encountered all over Scotland. Now, going back to this trip to the Bass Rock, it was organised by the Scottish Seabird Centre in North Berwick. Susan Davis is the chief executive. So before we set sail for the Rock, I asked her how things had been for the centre since lockdown began.
Well, at the very start of lockdown, it was an extremely challenging and worrying time for us. We rely as a charity very much on the income that we get through the visitor attraction. And when we had to close the doors of the visitor attraction in March, that basically turned off the tap to our income, which would, over the summer season, generate enough to carry us through the winter as well. So it was a, you know, like for many organisations, we've had a pretty challenging time through lockdown.
But you'd also just finished a major renovation of the premises behind me. You'd chucked a lot of money at it, so you were in the worst possible position.
Yeah, I mean, we were really fortunate in that we got backing from a range of funders to refurbish the centre in 2019. So we'd spent £800,000-£900,000 on a refurbishment of the cafe area, the retail offer, but also, importantly, on the discovery experience, so that they were more able to tell the story about Scotland's marine environment to a wider audience. And we'd only reopened our doors in December 2019, had 2 months in effect of trading after that reopening, and then were faced with the COVID closure.
Isn't it astonishing how different £900,000 sounds in broad daylight as opposed to at 2 o'clock in the morning when you wake up thinking about it?
It does.
£900,000!
Yeah, but you know, with that money, what we've been able to do is we've been able to upgrade the camera technology on the Bass Rock, so you now get a much better stream from the cameras of gannets on the Bass Rock throughout the year. We've put in a whole range of interactive technologies within the centre. We've got new virtual reality that shows people what they'll find under the sea in the marine environment, as well as what you see above the sea, and a whole range of new storyboards. So we're much better able not only to tell the story about Scotland's seabirds, but to tell people about the threats to the marine environment, to tell them about things like coral and kelp that they'll find in the marine environment and their importance, and also to try and prompt people to think about what it is that they can do to help protect that marine environment too. So £900,000 sounds a lot of money, but for what we've delivered in the centre, I think it's very good value for money.
But you were really close to going under, and you had an appeal. Yep. And you've got good news.
Yeah, we do have. So for the first time in the charity's history, in May we launched a public appeal for funding, and we'd set a target of £200,000 to be raised through that public appeal. It was an urgent appeal. And the reason for that target was that it would also help us lever in some additional funding as well. And, you know, absolutely delighted, and we feel very humbled by the response that we've had to that appeal. We raised our £200,000 through that and some other, you know, charitable donations which came in, and that's enabled us to lever in match funding as well. So it's great. It seems, again, like a lot of money. But the challenge for us is we're almost through the busy season, we're going into the shoulder months, and we need the money to keep, you know, the charitable activities going over the winter period too. But hugely relieved, hugely grateful to the people who have supported us.
I mean, just looking around a day like today, I mean, we were both saying just earlier, I can't remember seeing North Berwick as busy as this. But, you know, this is hugely popular. There are people wanting to come here to experience this, to learn.
Yeah. Absolutely. People want to come, they want to learn. I think, though, that, you know, our unique position on the edge of the Firth of Forth, we not only have the indoor offer to give people, but we can also put things on to give people an outdoor experience as well. So, again, subject to the Scottish Government, you know, guidelines, we hope that we'll be able to do our rock pooling sessions, some of our outdoor learning activities, some guided walks for people. And it's a safer environment outdoors as well at the moment. So there's lots of potential for us to engage with a wide range of people.
And all in the of the Bass Rock. Now, I've got close, I've got on a boat and I've been round it.
Yep.
I've never been on it.
Me too.
But you're coming as well.
I'm coming as well because, like you, I've been round it, but I've never been on the Bass Rock. And so today's going to be an experience for us all.
This is going to be quite a day.
Absolutely.
It is. The Bass Rock Spectacular. What we've got, again, on the doorstep for us is the fantastic resource of the world's largest gannet colony, Northern Gannet Colony. And it's, you know, it's spectacular whether you're viewing it from within the discovery experience, whether you're taking a boat trip around it. But to land, I believe, is an altogether different sensation and different experience. So we're one of the lucky few.
Absolutely. Susan Davis, Chief Executive of the Scottish Seabird Centre there. And coming up very shortly, our trip to the Bass Rock begins in earnest.
Yeah, and you wonder why it's hard to get sympathy for working this programme. Now, have you seen any geese yet? I saw some yesterday afternoon. They're just lovely. And the return's a sure sign that the seasons are changing. The autumn's here. Writer and audio producer Rebecca Smith lives near Falkirk, and she's lucky enough to have a particular breed of goose nearby.
At the very beginning of autumn, the first time you notice the air feels different, or the edge of a crown of sycamore is starting to deepen to a russet reddy brown, there is a sense of restlessness I'd always associated with the start of a school year. From the age of 4, autumn signified a new term, a fresh start, the possibility of new friends, a new home, a potential adventure. And it seems I'm not alone. As we pack our school bags, plan our timetables, sharpen our pencils, geese who have spent the summer in Western Siberia and Scandinavia, under northern lights if they're lucky, start to act a little restless too. Their journey south is about to begin. There is a name for this disquiet as the seasons begin to change. Zugunruh, coined by German scientists, means migratory restlessness. Even caged birds feel it. A fluttering of wings. A feeling there is something you have to do, somewhere you have to be. An anxiousness. When the geese appear in the grey wet sky as if by magic in the red arrow formation, we point them out to each other and I wonder, where are they going? Where have they been? How many hours have they been flying before settling down on our coasts? Before I was too busy with my own settling to even consider theirs. This year, of course, the turning of the earth, month after month, and finally into another season, has been more evident. I feel like we've been placed on a child's globe, and we can feel a rotation more acutely than ever before. A pandemic shakeabout has rearranged what we believe to be important, to be useful, what we decide to ignore and what we decide to notice. So when I read about the group of tiger bean geese, who have been coming to the same spot for 40 years, just 20 minutes from where I live, I wanted to stop and notice this in particular. In a few weeks, we can hope to welcome over 200 tiger bean geese to the UK. These geese only winter in two places in Britain, the Yare Marshes in Norfolk and the Slemannan Plateau just south of Falkirk. Named for their breeding grounds, in the subarctic forests in Sweden and parts of Russia, they come here via varying flight paths. They have a dark brown plumage, a sleek body, and a longer neck than its cousin, the tundra bean goose. They have bright orange legs. They are a protected species, this group in Norfolk falling to just a handful now. They make their home from October to April in the flat fields around Slemannan, caring for their young, enjoying the low varied temperatures of Scotland's winter. It is only through the hard work of passionate individuals we know anything about these birds. Some have been tagged and are followed throughout their migratory journey. It is how we know the bean goose pairs stay together throughout their whole lives. Couples feed together and rarely leave each other's side. It is also how we know that sometimes they get lost, but incredibly, often find their way back home again. Migratory birds are amazing. I've always known birds fly south to Africa, swallows, martins, warblers and flycatchers, but never much thought about the northern birds. The geese, such as the Greenland barnacle geese, pink-footed geese and Svalbard geese, who also fly south but set off from their starting position of the snowy northern grounds. They, like me, prefer the cooler climate and consider not one but two northern places to be home. I have lived in Scotland for almost as many years as I've lived in Cumbria and call both these rain-swept, mountainous, watermarked places home. We cheer every time we cross the border on the M6, whether we're going north or south. Each place has its own personality, its own spirit. I love the dry stone houses of Cumbria. I love the moors and rivers of Scotland, the watercourses bursting after seasonal or now unseasonal storms. I visit family and friends and drive the same roads I learnt to drive on. Seeing how the fields have changed since last time I was there. Trees flushing, leaves dropping, buzzard after buzzard after buzzard. A cuckoo for the first time in years. Each visit resets something inside me, no matter what time of year it is. Maybe it settles my restlessness, my zugunru. Then when I come home to Scotland, everyday life swallows us up and I crave for a walk in the woods and notice a change in light, in colour, in temperature, in sound. Everything is always changing. Somehow, each place manages to ground me, restore me, like a mug of really good coffee or a piece of dark chocolate. The pandemic has meant there are less people flying south for some summer sun just now. Maybe the migratory birds will have more room in the sky. What this has meant for the beautiful places I can call home is more people. The roads, the campsites, hotels, bed and breakfast, they've been busy. Some would say overwhelmed. In the bird world, this is called eruptive migration, a migration that is irregular between years, such as when low food supplies in one area causes mass movement to another. It is common in finches and waxwings. There is no excuse for images I've seen of littered campsites, woodlands with trees half sawed through. It is dangerous, this lack of care for our natural environment. But I understand the need to migrate, to reset and restore. I wish people would watch the dots on the map where the geese and swallows undertake their journey. As we eat our lunch, as we walk to school or shop for tea, they dot to dot to dot. The geese, whose ultimate destination is up the road from me, have flown throughout Sweden, Denmark and Norway and across the North Sea to our shores. How could you not appreciate the natural world when we see how a goose travels? As the weeks wear on and the world grows darker, we should be able to welcome back these incredible and adventurous birds. They might get blown off course, they might lose their way, but eventually they find their ground and again in the low key beauty of Slemanen. Watch out for these simple strokes of charcoal on a glass blue sky. By the time we settle into our new routines this autumn, new timetables, new friends, new adventures, the tiger being geese will be finishing their journey and starting the process of settling as well.
Rebecca Smith and the tiger bean geese of Slemanen. I went going to see them a couple of years ago. Beautiful animals. Coming up on Out of Doors, Ewan marks the move into autumn with a wee poem, and we get literally knee-deep in gannets. He was attacked from behind several times, viciously, but bore it bravely.
Gosh, it was bleeding.
It was a scratch. It was a flesh wound.
I still have a, scar. I mean, you're talking about rare birds. I saw it at Lochinvar Beg, the crane are displaying, which we did a piece on cranes the other day, and that's a fantastic sign. But the other thing I was thinking, when Rebecca was talking about cheering going over the border, I tend to do it only when I'm coming back into Scotland. But it struck me last time, we need a better sign. You know, folk are listening from the Scottish Government. It's just a big kind of thing, welcome to Scotland. Let's have a big, exciting sign.
Big, with lights, flashing, everything. Time to test your grey matter now with another little burst of our mystery bird. We've had some early attempts. Have another listen.
So if you know what that might be, have a go, or you can get in touch. Email outofdoors at bbc.co.uk or give us a phone, 08 085 92 95 00. I don't think I would have got that.
I think I would have done. Over the years, moving on, we've had access to many wonderful places at home and abroad. Just a couple of weeks ago, both of us fulfilled one of our dreams by setting foot on the largest northern gannet colony in the world on the Bass Rock near North Berwick.
Yeah, it had been stymied the week before because it was really bad weather, but this time it was picture postcard perfect. And we set off from North Berwick in the company of our guide Maggie Seddon from the Scottish Seabird Centre.
The rock's only a couple of hundred metres away in front of us now. Once upon a time, it was green. It's now white, because it's just covered in these white birds and the guano. But the sky is full of them too. It's just a blizzard of birds above this rock against a blue sky. Fabulous spectacle. This is the point where it's starting to get real.
Well, you say real, it's almost surreal. I was trying to find words, and I'm sure you'll have a good go at it, to describe what we're seeing. It's just thousands of birds and a vortex going right round the cliffs, and the noise is beginning to build as well. Yeah, Alan and the guys are just nudging us alongside the landing stage. These thousands, tens of thousands of birds just perched on the rock.
Yeah. Every available space.
All right, Andy, I'm all ready. Here you go.
Yeah, that should be good day.
We're locked at that. Rope's broken, Andy, hold on!
Broken!
Rope's clear.
Well, that's a bit entertaining. We were moored up to the Bass Rock there, and all of a sudden the rope broke, and there's a chance of fouling the prop, so a wee bit of jeopardy.
Yeah, it's real precision stuff. We're going to keep quiet, because Alan's getting orders shouted at him. It seems kind of inch-perfect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you copy the way it's tied on? Can you copy it the same way it was tied on? So put it up through that first loop and then down onto that and tie it off. Just explain when you get up there, Alan.
It's quite a big swell. It's covered in barnacles. If he gets this wrong, I'll rip the side of the thing off. I'm not making this up, there is a bit of tension here. Because there is about a metre swell. Right, we dropped Alan off.
Yeah.
And Maggie.
Yeah. Eventually we're going to be the only two sitting here. Oh, I just got splattered there. There's a cliff face, which would be what, facing effectively south. Now, thousands of birds on the top of the cliff face, but obviously they're flying in front of the cliff face, and because the sun, it's late afternoon, you can see the shadows of hundreds of birds crossing this pale grey cliff face. It's just hypnotic.
Wow, it's been a long time in coming, but we're actually on the platform at the bottom of the Bass Rock.
And every possible bit of land is covered in the gannets, some immature ones there as well, but fantastic.
How did this become the biggest gannet tree in the world?
Gannets are colonial birds, and they've actually been recorded here since probably about the 6th century. They take to the cliffs and they actually attract other birds coming in. So slowly over the years it's grown, but importantly it's actually down to the food stocks. If you don't have the food, the birds won't keep returning. So as the cliffs kind of were filled up, they slowly encroached on the edges of the rock. And once the lighthouse keepers left, I think that was really when we saw quite a dramatic increase in numbers. These were the times when seabirds numbers were increasing all around, which was wonderful. We had amazing fish stocks then, and then come the 90s, 2000, you started to see a slight decline. But gannets, because they can travel much further for food and they can take such a variety of prey, that's why they've actually feared this crash that some of the seabirds have had. Now, that said, we can't be complacent. After the Bistron East in 2018, we saw quite devastating signals up here that all was not well. And when the researchers came on, the birds were, well, it was empty. We were horrified. Where were all the birds? So when they did finally arrive and we weighed them, they were several kilos underweight. Many of them didn't breed that year. That was a vital year. So it's taken a couple of years to recover. They've had the rock to themselves this year, right up until July, and that's been quite interesting to see where some have taken over. It's been fabulous.
Every now and again, one comes in with, looks like a mouthful of seaweed. Looks like a big beard.
It is. It is seaweed, actually, Ewan. It's absolutely... They're nest building. They nest build...
Why at this time of year?
Right up until the time we leave. The territory is the most important thing to the gannet. Even if the chick falls out, too bad. The territory is what the gannet's life is about.
Maggie Sheridan there, the queen of the bass, and we'll have much more from the Bass Rock coming up very soon. Now, Thursday was National Poetry Day. On that, I'm combining two things here. National Poetry Day and the mystery bird. Because this has come in from John and Lewis in Rothie Norman, saying, "Good morning, gentlemen, from a wet Rothie Norman. Yon bird is up, blah. On a very squeaky field gate in the wind. Cheers for Wrinkly Tin County." Excellent. Dennis Forbes Grattan says, "I remember having a drift scuba dive at Bass Rock and I remember the incredible smell and noise of the place, but it was a great dive." Michael Craig from Sunny Johnshaven says, "I doubt it somehow, Michael," says, "I think the mystery bird is a blah. I've been lucky and fortunate enough to watch and hear them for years at our local National Nature Reserve. And Andrew Thompson managed to get it right too, says, lovely to wake this morning to the beautiful call of a blah and got the answer right." So, interesting, very interesting. Anyway, as I was saying, National Poetry Day, last Thursday, Mr. McElraith in the poetic frame of mind, inspired by autumn and what it holds.
As northern winds chase summer days, and skeins of geese arrive to graze, to clear the path for autumn's gift that takes the soul and spirit's lift. As leaves they fall and cider apples crush, I stand in awe at nature's brush. The brush that paints the country spread, the russets, ochres, browns and red, it's red, in all its hues that chases pending winter blues. The violet glow of Victoria plum, the rosehip fruit that greets the sun, the orange, the tans, the fruits so mellow that turn the beech the deepest yellow, the apples, rowan, brambles, gean, the senses heighten, ever keen. Holly berries for Christmas wait, to bring autumn glow to Christmas cake, the rowan tree with berries rich, the rowan tree that bars the witch. The badger's poo all stained dark red, a feast of brambles on which he fed. The damsons bubble making jam, from black to purple in the pan. The aspen, beech, the larch, the birch, the oak, the elm, it's nature's church. The horse chestnut tree, the first to shed, but best of all, the apple red. It's red in all its hues that comforts us through winter blues. The alchemy of colours hearten, it's nature's gift, it's nature's tartan. The gift from Mother Earth our souls beguile, it's red that makes me smile.
An autumnal ode there from Mr. Ewan McElraith, spinster of this parish.
I wasted on this programme, you know.
You are, actually. You are, actually. If Liz Lockhead's listening, we know. There's no...
If you're a fan of dum-de-dum poetry, then that's the kind of thing for you.
Which what she once said to you. I mean, that's neither here nor there, has to be said. But it's true, it's a fabulous time of year. I saw on Twitter, I mean, you weren't just... You've got a cider press, obviously. You weren't just crushing apples. You had grapes out your greenhouse, too.
Oh, absolutely. The grape juice was fantastic. But the apples issue, it's the first thing I've done it, where I chucked, usually you mince them up, but I chucked them in the freezer. and there are a lot of very small pink ones that are usually red ones that I usually don't bother with. I froze them and crushed them, and the juice came out the most beautiful champagne pink, you know, like like forced rhubarb, that wonderful delicate colour. I had some this morning when I got up at 4 o'clock for rehearsals. And I had to redo that poem because the pedant who shares my house, I had the dams and berries in the pan. What's wrong with that?
The dams and berries. Oh no. They're not really berries, are they? They're fruits.
Correct, yeah. Damson have a single stone, which makes it a member of the plum family, so it's a fruit. So I had to go back out down the road because it was too noisy here because they were sowing barley yesterday to re-record that little bit. So, salient point, yeah. Because I was saying, it doesn't matter, it's a poem, it's created. Don't go and read it.
Well, you will live with a teacher, what can you do? When I was walking week before last, certainly across the moors and things like that, you can see that a lot of the berries had been taken. I'm assuming something like grouse, etc. But, you know, these purple stains on the path all over the place. You know, and you referred to the badger poo there. For some reason, I don't know what it is at this time of year, you start to notice stuff like that.
Yeah, it just suddenly comes out. There is that, you know, you always get carried away, but that red isn't there in the summer. It's just, you know, suddenly in autumn, it's right in your face. Everything's red or variations thereof. Yeah. It's a wonderful time of year as the rain comes down.
Yeah, I'm not much of a gardener, but we've got something in the garden. It was given to us by friends. It's gone yellow and orange and green and bronze and just, I mean, it's one plant. It's just absolutely astonishing. I am sheltering in about the only 3 square feet of dry to be found in BBC Aberdeen's car park. The wind is coming from the west. The rain is coming from the west. Or it was torrential earlier. You can hear it torrential up in Banff. Is it raining as hard as that up in Banff?
Yeah, it's just started now. Have a wee listen to this. It is beginning to chuck it down. No wind, thankfully, so it's coming straight down, so it's missing me a lot. There was a little squeak during the news. That was me as a drop of rain went down the back of my neck. Rather unpleasant.
You are so brave. So brave. We continue our trip to the Bass Rock coming up. Home to over 150,000 gannets. We're also going to chuck in a heap of history as well. And this week's mystery bird.
So, if you think you know what that is, give us a call. We're on 08085 92 95 00. You can text us on 80295 or email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
You will have noticed a slight avian theme to the programme this week. On that subject, yesterday I thought, oh, the swallows have gone, because it was a miserable morning. And then it was a beautiful afternoon, and the swallows came back again. So I don't know what they're playing at. They're hanging around here in October, and they've got to get to Africa. So come on, screw the nut. Anyway, our archive piece this week continues in a similar birdie vein.
Yeah, last November I went to Carlops to visit Jill Noble on her farm. Now, I wasn't there to see a fancy bit of machinery or any of her livestock. I was there to see a jackdaw. A jackdaw called Jacko, who Jill had rescued from certain death.
I was in the cattle shed one day and this jackdaw nest fell off the rafters right in front of us. 2 young in it, one of them was dead and the other one was scrabbling about, and the cat was scrabbling about as well. So as you do, you pick it up and brought it up and put it in a box.
Then
the gape is looking at you, this big red mouth. Of course, it just gobbled everything I gave it in the box and just grew. The only downside is that with the fall, we reckon it's a she must have tweaked her beak. I unbelievably took her to the vets at the bush, and we think she maybe fractured her bottom jaw when she fell, but it wasn't very apparent at the beginning, it wasn't apparent at all. But as she's grown, she's got this slightly twisted beak, which doesn't affect anything, except that possibly that's why she comes back and has her supplementary food from me, I don't know.
So what stage is she at now?
She'll be, 5 months or something, 4 months? June, once she could fly, I let her out and I actually took her on holiday. I went up north and there was nobody to feed her every few hours, so she had to come to, and she actually learnt to fly on this Scottish island where I was staying.
Did you not think you're going to lose her at that point? You know, you open the doors and bye-bye.
Yeah, she couldn't really fly when we were there, but she was taking her first steps. Anyway, we came back and I let her out and she just flies around the farm, basically. And if she sees me, she comes flying down onto my shoulder. If she's flying with her pals, I can shout. She comes veering out the sky and does a loop-the-loop and lands on my head or whatever.
And you were talking to her?
I talked to her, yeah, but she talks to me. I mean, I talk to everything, but she talks to me.
Now, we're going to get over and listen to the recording in a wee while because you've actually got her locked up at the moment.
I took the liberty of... I don't like closing her in at all because she's free. She comes back when she wants. She goes away when she wants. She mostly comes back at night, the afternoons, and goes into the aviary where I reared her. And she roosts there. But sometimes she stays out all night and the next night. And in September, she disappeared for about 3 weeks and I thought she was gone, she was dead. So that was that. Anyway, after 3 weeks, she appeared back even fatter than she was when she left, which proves she can feed herself, and all her new feathers, adult feathers, were grown in. But she had a sneeze, a bad sneeze, you know, a virus or whatever. So I did take her to the bush again, and they actually jagged her with antibiotics, but we think it was a virus, and it took about 3 weeks to go. So I shut her in for about a week at that point, after which time she was hopping to get out. So she's been free ever since.
Well, tell me about the talking. Why did that come about?
I don't know, really. I think possibly when they're maturing, I think, or maybe it's the squint beak, I don't know, but she certainly talks. She's even got my parrots. I've got African grey parrots. They actually imitate her now, which is really quite funny. So I've got it outside and I've got it inside as well.
So where is she at the moment?
So she's in an aviary in here.
Okay.
So and I can guarantee when I open it,
she'll fly out. But
she'll fly
that's
out.
That's okay. She's a wild bird.
She's a wild bird. If I call her, she comes down. She usually comes around the garden with me in the morning on my shoulder. And then I drive down to the yard to feed cattle and things. And she hops about the rooftops and flies down and flies back up and chats to everyone from the roof.
Well, dealing with wildlife, it's never predictable. And I've got a big, huge, furry microphone that looks like a cat.
Well, so if you stand back.
She might not be that keen, but no. Yeah, you go for it.
OK, I'll just see what happens. Okey-doke.
Quite exciting. Just opening the door.
Jackal, you can come out now. You can come out now, Jackal.
Going into the aviary, I'm staying back.
She's actually just had a bath.
She's just had a bath.
She likes to have a bath every day when she comes back. She doesn't like the come on, Jackal.
Where? Oh, yeah.
You coming?
She's lovely.
She'll come down in a minute if we stand back.
Give her some time,
I'm quite sure she'll come back. Yeah, she seems to come in and have a bath, have some more food, and then flies off again. It's a great life. She can live wild or come and help herself.
She's got a real sense of satisfaction.
Yes. I mean, I would never keep a bird like that in a cage. And you just see how wild birds are when I see her flying around, because she doesn't come near me when somebody's here, like you.
That's me.
I have land at the other side of the main road, the other side of Carlops, and sometimes when I'm going around the cattle there, she comes flying out of the sky and lands on my shoulder. So she's obviously flying quite a distance.
Well, I'll maybe get out of her line of sight and see if that helps her. There she's arrived, and on your shoulder.
Oh. Scared of you?
She's giving me a funny look.
Yeah. She's all wet.
She's looking a bit drooked. You can see a slight bend in the beak.
Yeah, it's just a wee bend. It doesn't seem to do any harm, really.
It's giving us a right old dying.
She will take off in a minute, and she goes right up in the air and then does these incredible drops to earth, where I think, well, that's it, she's going to break her neck.
She does, she's us.
Yeah, she's waving for her friends now.
What a lovely story.
Ewan speaking to Jill Noble there, and you'll be delighted to hear that Jacko's gone from strength to strength. We've got an update from Jill, and she says Jacko's now 17 months old and has just been through a molt when she looked like a taxidermed animal or an old stuffed toy. A few weeks on, she looks all shiny and sleek with green and purple body feathers, distinct grey shawl and the Jackdaw jet black cap.
Yeah, she knows the best chance of getting my attention is to shout down the chimney so that the sound reverberates around the kitchen. And if that doesn't work, she hops up on the windowsill, looks through each window in turn to see where I am. So, never getting a sleep in here.
Says Jacko hangs about the farm most mornings, often perched on my shoulder as I go about the early morning farm chores, often hopping onto a horse or the goat to warm her feet. Unfortunately, she poos when it takes a fancy, and regularly folk to the farm have stopped telling me that I have white blobs down my back. I hardly notice her hanging on there now, and I equally hardly notice lift off as she heads off out to the fields.
She seems very content, and it'll be interesting to see if she lessens her human hold and finds a mate next year. I certainly hope so. The rain is bucketing down there.
Yeah, same here.
It's quite loud.
Yeah.
But what's been magical, the light is coming in, and the first thing I saw was a robin appeared just on the sundial, about 10 feet from me, then another robin, and then a wren, and I kid you not, I have a red squirrel about 8 feet from my feet.
Oh, get out of here.
The first peanut of the day. Yeah. It's braving the... I've got two of them, and they've had about a kilogram of peanuts already. They're burying them all over the place. Whether they'll find them again, I don't know, but it's kind of distracting from the rain anyway. It's lovely.
When I was walking, I came out of Crean Larrack early one morning, and the place is infested with red squirrels. Absolutely infested. I mean, every corner you turned, there was another squirrel scampering across the road. Beautiful wee animals. Anyway, Jill was talking there about the fact that Jacko, her jackdaw, poos down her back. Seriously, when you're talking about covered in poo, only a complete idiot, of which there were two, would go to the Bass Rock, the biggest northern gannet colony in the world. And then let's face it, they're pretty incontinent. Neither of us wearing a hat. This was not good. Our guide, Maggie Sheridan, took us to meet the residents. This time of year, the youngsters, the Guga, are fledging.
Well, when we're heading up the steps here, do take care. We've got one lone Guga up there getting prepared to jump. This is a journey for it. It's right at the gateway beside the lighthouse. So as we head up, I will look up and check that you pass it quite carefully, because to get 9-10 pounds of birds landing on your head is not fun. That being said, they need the uplift of the wind. Now it's windier. This morning it wasn't. And rest assured, no, it's flapping its wings.
Oh, thinking about it.
It'll be inflating its air sacs. It gets you all excited, and then it goes, oh, I'm not doing that. No, I'm not ready. not my turn. If it's got friends up there...
It's easier for them on a windy day.
Yes, yeah, because they take off. That's why the cliff sites are so good. Because for gannets, that is the best area for gannet. You stretch your wings, you'll get the uplift of the wind. If they don't get that, we saw this morning, they actually went splat. Well, they didn't quite go splat, but they really bounced. They've got a huge big layer of fat on them.
Uh-huh.
So this is its first flight.
This is
a big
first ever
big
flight.
Leap of faith, isn't it?
Well, it's maybe kind of jumped, well, it probably fell down from the rock and landed in this area, because I've been freeing them this morning. They've been trapped up there this morning. Uh-huh. But this is it. This is its first journey. It's been drawn to the sea. It knows it has to go there. And at the nesting site, it's been 12, 13 weeks on the nest. So you see the behaviour change. And it's quite interesting. I was on the rock the other day and I went, they're not ready. They were dark speckled. They're Gugas. They've got no down on them. There's something that tells you it's just not ready to leave the rock yet.
You make your way up a cement set of steps with a red handrail at the side. And then you come up to the old part. Now, what would have been a prison complex here? And there's a doorway. And through the doorway is floating hundreds of tiny white feathers, downy feathers. And behind that, hundreds, thousands of gannets occupying every square inch. Isn't that just fascinating?
It's incredible, but I'm told there's a couple of birds up here will attack you.
All right. You go first, you go short. Look at that chick there. The chicks that are ready to fledge are actually grey,
But that's one that's much younger. It's still got the downy feathers. And it's white. And then they go to sort of an intermediate stage. We are within 4 or 5 feet of these gannets. They've got these incredible...
The eyes.
It's the eyes are mad. Pale blue eyes. Yellowish heads. I've never been as close to this as gannets. I had no idea that the feet were actually limbed and yellow either. That's beautiful. But look at that beak. Sharp.
That's 5 inches of dagger.
Yeah, I think you need to go first. Go on, here. Don't turn your back on them. They can smell fear, you know.
Thank you.
Yep, Maggie must have a key.
Have a padlock.
There's a sign that says, before you actually get through this gate, the Bass Rock is a place of great interest to ornithologists and historians. The owners accept no liability for any accident or misadventure while visitors are on the rock. Birds must be left undisturbed. Visitors should remain in the concrete path at all times, north of Berwick Estate.
Welcome to the prison.
Dun, dun, dun!
A prison and a fortress long before it was ever a gannetry of this size. We came in this morning and opened the gate, and there was 2 young googas in here just jumping about and yipping, so they had to be freed. So quite often you don't quite know what you're going to meet when you open this gateway. It's fun.
See, when you're handling the birds, even if they're young birds, do you get apprehensive? I mean, because they've got a fair beak on them.
You have to be sensible about it. You never bend down to pick up a gannet. And we will wear gloves. And now with all health and safety and things, if you're working with them, you have to wear goggles. But if you're rescuing one and it's just on the beach or it's somewhere, even up here this morning, I was on the roof taking some off the roof. And you don't have time to start doing all that. You grab them by the throat. The most important thing is get them under that neck. And that quite often they'll have your other finger while you've done that. But it's lovely to try and help a bird, but if you really don't know how to handle them, call somebody who will. The first time I rescued one, it had a broken wing. By the time I came back along the beach with it, it had blood pouring down its front because it caught both my fingers as I tried to get one finger that was entangled in the bill, and I put my other hand in and it got both my hands. One of my more stupid moments.
There's a bird just on a ledge about 15, 20 feet from us. Is he ready to go, or she ready to go?
Yes, indeed. She has left the nest and is just working her way down the rock. We've got another one here just on part of the old prison cells, in fact. And it's perched quite beautifully on the rock, very, very photogenic there. And they've now still got to find their way out. This is a problem. This part's enclosed. They need to get to the sea, to the cliff edge, for them to be able to actually get off this rock. This is gannet's intelligence. To the right-hand side of them is a gate that's about 6-8 feet of open space. And you have 6 or 8 birds behind the gate.
So do you have to move them?
Probably.
Well, I'm not volunteering because Mark and I don't know how to do it.
I will. The problem is I'll probably go up there and try and scare them round.
Is that them sounding unhappy?
It is. Let's go. Somebody's coming towards us. Yeah.
That's just so daft. You know, big gap one side. Yeah. And they're all behind the gate. They're not bright, are they?
They're not the brightest things. And they've got this kind of... Oh.
She's got one by the neck. She's got two by the neck.
That's quite a skill.
Yeah, it is.
Don't jump, boys. Not yet.
Not yet. Just wait.
Calm.
You wouldn't think the wings on that one were strong enough to actually.
You wouldn't thought, because that's quite a heavy looking bird. Yeah. Maggie's going in there with the neck.
If one escaped.
Yeah. She's got one by the back of the neck.
Oh, it's. This one's fighting her.
Yeah, it's winning.
It's a whole new daytime sport here.
There's a whole dose of them just gone, nah, we're not doing this again, and they've leapt off the gap.
I'm going to go into the bit where she was chasing the gannets out from, because I want to see what's actually down there. And effectively, well, I can understand now why those young gannets are refusing to jump. It's about a 40, 50 foot drop down onto the rocks. And the waters may be, yeah, I don't know, as many yards or metres away. It's a fair jump.
I just watched one, and it's kind of free fall for about 50 feet, and it bottomed out. It must have cleared that rock by about 4 or 5 feet, and then it took off again. And it's out to sea out there at the moment. So at least one of them's made it. Sadly, a couple of them haven't.
Yeah.
There's one hit the ground, not too heavily, but it's on its feet. So hopefully it'll make it. It's certainly walking.
The thing is, it's quite dangerous for them because they can either break their necks, or we saw a couple with broken wings. You know, and that's it. It's cut and sisk after that. You know?
Yeah, they kind of had it, but there's so many birds, you know, a tiny percentage of them don't make it. But as you'll hear later on, it just gets better and better. I mean, I've done wildlife programmes all over the world, and the Bass Rock is right up there with some of the best in the world.
It is really hard just to describe how spectacular it is, but if you head to our Facebook page, the Outdoors Facebook page, we've stuck some pictures up there, and fairly soon there's going to be some video too.
Yeah, you might even see my gashed leg bleeding helplessly on the rock. Anyway, you heard our guide Maggie mentioning the prison on the rock, but there's other buildings there as well. Now, to give us a wee insight into the history of the rock is local historian and writer Ilse Fortune. Good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning to you too, Ilse. Just out of curiosity, before we talk about the history, have you ever actually been out on the rock with the gannets?
Well, yes, I have actually, Mark. I was listening to you talking about a gashed leg. Uh-huh.
Oh, that's you, and he's whinging. He's just whinging.
And it reminded me, well, several years ago, I landed on the Bass Rock, went out with a photographer who's doing, bird photographs, we were taken there by Chris Marr of the Marr family, who had the Sula, took people out to the Bass Rock, and I wandered off, and I was nipped in the shin by a gannet who was pretty angry because I was just about to stand on its neck. So yes, I've been to the Bass Rock and I've seen the gannets.
Yeah, no, I remember going out to the Bass Rock once with Freddie Marr, which I think Chris's dad, I think, but the weather was bad and we couldn't get on at that time. Just how far back does human habitation go on the Bass Rock? What's the earliest record of it?
Well, yeah, so the Bass really belongs to the birds, and it's so inhospitable that few people have actually stayed there voluntarily. But the earliest recorded person who stayed there was a chap called St. Baldred, but there's actually few hard facts about his life. We're not even sure of the dates he was alive. One account says he died on the Bass Rock in 603, and the other one is 150 years later, in 756. There might have been two St. Baldreds, but I think there were probably just one. I think we should go with one. One interesting fact there is that both accounts say that he died on the 6th of March. So I think we know that for certain. He was a man of God. He encouraged the spread of Christianity. And in those days, it was quite normal for a Christian missionary to use an island as a retreat and then travel to the mainland to preach and convert.
Who actually owns the rock?
It's owned at the moment by the Dalrymple family. They've owned it since 1706. I don't know, it might have been given to them by the Crown, or they certainly got it from the Crown at that time. At an end of a very turbulent period on the Bass.
We passed through what Maggie described as the prison. Who was actually imprisoned there? What kind of people?
Right, OK, well, that prison was once the castle of the Lauders, who originally, they were the original owners of the Bass, or the earliest owners of the Bass. And from time to time, people were imprisoned there. On one occasion, going back a long time, Robert III sent his son, James, his son and heir, to the Bass Rock for safety while they were waiting for a ship to be ready to take him off to France, where he was going to go in exile, because his father, Robert, thought that the noblemen were going to try and kill him, Scottish nobles were going to try and kill him. He was ultimately imprisoned in England. He was captured, imprisoned in England. And when he eventually got back to Scotland and became king, he put his uncle, sent his uncle as prisoner to the Bass Rock in revenge for not paying the ransom from the English.
See, it's interesting. People refer to it as the Scottish Alcatraz. The similarities are legion, not least of which being you can see civilization from where you're stuck in a rock.
You can see civilization, but you can't really partake of it very much.
Yeah. Must have been pretty tough for the people that were there, and the Jacobites were imprisoned there too. Tell me, how many Stevenson connections are there to the rock?
Oh, right. I was going to, just before I go onto the Stevenson, I was going to say, of course, the biggest prisoners, I should have said before, were, of course, the Covenanting prisoners.
Yes, aye.
They were imprisoned there in the late 17th century. It was a kind of it was a political and religious movement, and the Covenanters refused to accept King Charles II as head of the church in Scotland. They refused to accept the authority of the bishops. They were pushed out of their churches. They were Presbyterians. They were pushed out of their churches. And so they started to preach outside in the fields to people. And, of course, the government officials arrested them, sent them off to the Bass Rock. And there were about 40 of them there, and they were imprisoned there from between, I don't know, a few months and 6 years. The government played a cat-and-mouse game with them. They endured horrible conditions on the Bass Rock, and when they were about to die, the government allowed them back onto the mainland, back to civilization, to recuperate. And it was a really horrible existence.
It can't have been very pleasant. Listen, just in terms of time, Ilse, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there and perhaps revisit the Stevenson connection some other time. But thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Okay, then. Thanks, Mark. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. If you'd like to find out more about the trip to the Bass Rock, and I think I can speak for both of us here, it is well worth it, check out the Scottish Seabird Centre website. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing where people listen to the podcast. Email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Ola Christian Valla did. He says, I'm a Norwegian bus driver with a love of Scotland. My first visit to Scotland was in the late 80s after I moved to the Faroe Islands. It was the ferry Smyril to Skrabstad. After my first trip, I fell in love with Scotland. I visited countless times. My last trip was in 2015 when my son got married in Gretna Green. I also had a fun experience of driving the West of Scotland Tartan Army fans when Scotland played against the Faroe Islands in 2010. Excellent.
I think we lost that one. Maybe not. I love listening to your programme. I found it by total coincidence on a Saturday morning at work. Now I download the podcast. I love the description of places, talking with people there, and the soundscapes. I also enjoy the mystery bird, but so far I haven't been able to send you my guesses, but I do have a couple of right guesses occasionally.
Bird life of the Faroe Islands is very similar to bird life in Scotland, he says. One of my favourite birds is the oyster catcher. While living in the Faroe Islands, I had a couple that I used to feed with cheese. One of them was eating from my hand and would come into the house to do so. He also used to receive me when I came home from work and follow me up to the house. Sometimes I could walk in the neighbourhood with a handful of cheese and the bird walk with me, which used to amuse my neighbours. He adds that you should take a trip to the Faroe Islands and make some stories and interviews there. Kindest regards, Ola Christian Valla. I would be quite keen on that. I'd quite like to go to the Faroe Islands.
Edie's bringing you the best of her guests on the Start Talk podcast.
Physicality might have typecast you.
It was very hard to not get a part where it was either in the Navy or the Army or something. Yeah. But as I've got older, at least the rank has gone up.
Join her as she talks to actor James Cosmo and fashion revolutionary Mary Quant.
Were you trendy at school, though?
I was whiz at rearranging school uniforms.
Along with solo artist and lead singer of Texas, Charlene Spiteri.
You look gorgeous in some of the album covers.
That moment on the white on blonde sleeve where the only thing you see is my eyes. To me, I'm just like, that's wicked.
Stark Talk. Available now on BBC Sounds.
And also on BBC Sounds, you can catch up with all the sessions we've had on Radio Scotland's Live Music Week. I was listening to Another Country with Ricky Ross the other night, and they had a couple on Ferris and Sylvester. They're a couple, brilliant track, should have been on a train. But they recorded all this stuff at home because, you know, as they went into lockdown, what were we going to do? Well, let's record an album. And they were a live session. It's great, great, great music. And you, the sounds they've got from recording in the kitchen are just incredible. Yeah, Ricky Ross, Studio One, it's a really good listen. All my squirrels back again.
Yeah. Listen, just in the mystery bird this week, we've got a couple of wrong guesses. Maura Tui, Brottie Ferry says, yes, exactly, God bless you. Tony Hall, David Sky says, white-tailed eagle, nope. Ian, osprey. Gary and Penny Cook, is it a kestrel? Nope. And Willie the farmer near Brechin says, the mystery bird is a red kite. Said with great authority, Willie, and absolutely wrong. Keep going. This is with the sound of actually the mystery bird.
Sounds a bit like sooty, doesn't it? If you think you know, get in touch. Outdoors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or give Lewis a call. He's on 0800 085 9295.
You know, there's a terrible way your brain works in live radio. Was sooty the silent one, or was it sweep that was silent? Because I think sweep used to make a noise and sooty was mute. I don't know.
No, sooty. So, well, if you know the answer to that one. Yeah. 0800 085 9295. If you're a certain age, was Sooty the quiet one or was Sooty the squeaky one?
Absolutely. Time now to go back to the Bass Rock under the expert guidance of the Seabird Centre's Maggie Shedden, Queen of the Bass. Truth to be told, we actually thought we'd covered a lot of ground on the rock already, but there was still an incredible view to be seen.
We're going to start climbing higher onto the rock, up to near where the chapel that was built in dedication to St Baldred, and that's really one of our main areas. That's as high as we can reach now because the gantry spread so much, and that's fantastic. It'll be very noisy up there though. It's going to be fabulous. So at this time of year, and particularly today, we have seen a lot of birds leave the rock today and a few days prior. So the gannets now are just holding their territories. There's also non-breeding birds on the rock, and these are the ones that will tend to move as we head up, so you're not disturbing a gannet there. If a gannet's on its territory, it will stick with its territory. Did that one get you?
Yeah. Lovely.
This is where the camera, all the techie stuff with the camera is installed. Okay. And the centre, really in the middle of fine-tuning all this, we've been having fabulous new cameras in.
What is this?
This is old photographs of the Bass Rock.
Wow.
So you can actually age how the colony increased over the years.
Uh-huh.
So in the 60s, and this was when Brian Nelson was out, and I've got some fabulous photos from them.
That was when I was 1 year old. So there's practically no gannets on it at all. By the time you get to 84, half the island is green, half the island is white. 87 wasn't a particularly good breeding year, by the looks of it. Well, I'm going to say it was good as that.
Well, and then but you can see the increase there.
Yeah, and you get to this in the year 2000, and it's incredible, isn't it?
It's quite amazing.
Oh, we've got one on the steps in front of us. I don't know what it's likely to do.
This is all part of their treacherous journey. At the nest, they were quite safe. And one of the ones I freed down there, you could see it had been attacked. All the new feathers on its head had gone. So it's had a treacherous journey just to get out of the colony and make its way down. Mm-hmm. And then it gets stuck behind the gate, and I come in and grab it by its neck and go, freedom. And let's hope it makes it, because between 75 to 80% of these young birds in the first year will die. Mortality is incredibly high. And that's, you know, the gannetry is growing, but you have got to bear that in mind. We've had incredibly stormy days the last few days. And at the centre, Seabird Centre, I said, you're going to get gannets washed ashore. They said, we've been getting calls already this week. It was an onshore wind. Now, that we see. But if it's an offshore wind, you don't see they've died. And for them to be learning to fish, they're at the mercy of the tides. So they're just being washed in and washed out. Yeah. And that's what... It's really what we don't see.
Yeah. As is often the case with the marine environment, an awful lot of it is invisible to us, and therefore it's easy for folk to ignore.
I'm a bit busier now. You know, up until now, there's been an occasional bird beside the path. Now they're on it. Hundreds of them.
It's like Hitchcock.
Don't make me laugh. There's two birds here in the corner, young gannets on the corner here. For about the last 5-6 years, they have tried to nest on this corner, three of them. Because of COVID this year, they have won the site. And one of them thinks fledged. It's just, I'm just so pleased they have. I think for the birds that have been breeding, they're just much more relaxed now. They're not bringing in as much. And I think possibly...
Sneak attack from behind. What were you told about leading up against the pole?
I didn't realise they were going to come up from behind, though, and have a go.
You're nearly standing on its nest. What is it about you and birds? They really don't like you.
That's a 6-inch gash in my leg.
Oh, it is not.
Look at it.
It's a scratch.
They're definitely getting more defensive.
So this is about as high as we go in the colony. When I first used to land, well, you could really wander all the way up the rock. This was green, there was grass. I used to sit round the side of the chapel in the morning, early morning. It was like, yes, lovely morning sunrise. Look at it now. And the erosion, the wall behind you here, the chapel wall, when I first started, you could lean on it. And now it's only a few inches high. It's less than a metre, less than half a metre high now. That's how much the erosion has washed down the rock. And we really are down to bare rock now. On this area, further down, I'm still clearing landslides that are just slowly slipping down.
For all the years I've known you, I've never asked you this, but what's your background? How did you get into this in the first place?
I actually fell into it, to be honest, quite literally. I was a full-time carer to my father for years. And when, before the centre opened, they were needing volunteers to just inspire people and say what a wonderful place this was going to be. So I volunteered, and slowly I began to learn a little bit more. And to get people excited, you've got to learn a little bit. And when they started the boats, probably about two, by that time I was learning about the birds. I was going out with the bird counters. I do the bird counts in the first and fourth with the team. And the boats started, and they needed a guide. Now, when we came up here, the colony was growing, and by the time I saw people coming up, we would unpack their bags. It was four fabulous digital cameras. You just pulled it out, and phones and things. And I saw the lenses coming out and the tripods, and it was, sorry, time to go. So I went back to the Seabird Centre and I said, you know, I think photographic trips would be good. Allow people plenty of time. You can't absorb this in 10 minutes. I've been coming out here for I don't know how many years, and I still come out here and I see something new every time. I learn something. I love it. But I've got no sort of academic qualifications whatsoever. So I met some amazing people, and we get the scientists out, and they give me all their papers, and I love reading them. And then I go, what does that bit mean? Because I'm not academic, I'm not a scientist. And I think that's also nice to have that midway with somebody that goes, well, actually, I'm not academic. But if you want to learn more, then you can follow that pathway. But also to be able to just say to people, enjoy it. Look what you're seeing. listen, use your ears, because that's very important out here. When you're hearing things, there's something happening.
So the thing is, you're maybe not an academic, but you're an enthusiast. You love this.
I do.
That shines out.
Yes, I do. How can you not?
What a great way to finish, though, the top of the rock. And just that wall of noise is just mind-blowing.
Excellent, Maggie Shedden there. And I mean, that was a real privilege, Ewan, wasn't it? Just getting onto the Bass Rock amongst all those birds.
Well, as I said to you, I was out there. You know, I've been in Galapagos, so I made a couple of programmes out there, but the Bass Rock's right up there. It's unbelievably fantastic. And right, you know, 20 miles from Edinburgh, less than that, right on our doorstep. What a country.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just check with She Who Must Be Obeyed. Is the video up on Facebook yet? Not yet, it's going up shortly. There is a video there that will just give you a sense of the sheer scale, the number of gannets there. It's quite extraordinary. Thanks again to the Scottish Seabird Centre in North Berwick for organising that trip. Go onto their website if you fancy it yourself. It's a Hugh Dalrymple, who owns the island, very kindly gave us permission to land on the Bass Rock as well. So thank you very much for that. Time to reveal our mystery bird. Many, many attempts this week. Many of them correct. Kath and Gala Shields said, heading out to Orkney for the first time ever to work there for a couple of weeks, looking forward to it. Is the mystery bird a peregrine falcon? Yes, it is, Kath. Dougie Dargie in Glenrothes says, peregrine falcon. Dad's taxi is out and about today, maybe a cast or two later. Well, wear your waterproofs, Dougie. Willie says, is it a peregrine falcon? We have a returning breeding pair in a church tower in Gala Shields for some year. They screech over my garden daily. Same here in the car park in Aberdeen, Willie. Gordon Brown says, no doubt this time, that's a peregrine falcon's alarm call. Ailsa Smith in Cleese says peregrine falcon. Barry Sutherland, our South of Yorkshire ornithological correspondent, says peregrine falcon. Reg in Kirriemuir, peregrine falcon. Andrew Thompson gets it right. Duncan McCatt gets it right. Derek in Inverness gets it right. And Paddy in Aberdeen gets it right. It is indeed the peregrine falcon. So, Ewan's put this together. Let's hear why this bird holds such significance.
The peregrine falcon, or the duck hawk, as it's known in America, is the fastest animal on the planet, reaching a speed of 389 kilometres an hour as it hurtles towards the earth in its hunting dive. It's the world's most widespread raptor and is thought to be the fastest animal in the world at processing information. This is quite an animal and an extremely efficient predator. The bird takes to the skies, its keen eyesight spotting any movement of prey from on high. And then it throws its body over in the stoop like a spitfire going in for the kill. Pigeons, doves, songbirds and waders. If the target is in flight, as it gets closer, it clenches its talons, which it uses as a club to hit one of the prey's wings. This disables the target, but doesn't harm the falcon. It's also got a notch near to the tip of the beak which allows it to sever the spine of its prey. Clever, but nasty. The peregrine falcon is highly admired as a falconry bird, and it's been used in falconry for more than 3,000 years, beginning with the nomads in Central Asia. But not everyone could own a peregrine. Like many things in our history, there's a pecking order. The peregrine was only used by knights and aristocrats, while women used the smaller merlin, still called the lady's hawk. Priests used the sparrowhawk, and peasants used the goshawk or the kestrel. The rare greer falcon was reserved for kings, and only emperors were permitted to use an eagle. The peregrine falcon has been regarded as a mystic bird, and often as a messenger from another world, a stranger in ours. The Native Americans believed it to be a messenger that brings guidance from the spirit world. This idea partly comes from the fact that it's most active soon after dawn and in the evening twilight. And so the ancient Egyptians believed the falcon brought the sun in the morning and dragged it away in the evening.
Although the peregrine tends to arouse extraordinary devotion in many Faulkners and in most birdwatchers, in some, particularly pigeon fanciers, it causes an equally powerful hatred. Ironically, it was this loathing that led to the discovery that the species and perhaps the planet itself was in imminent danger of annihilation. During the Second World War, carrier pigeons were still an important means of communication, particularly in bringing messages back to England from occupied France. These birds, which flew steadily and fairly slowly, were the favourite meal of the peregrine falcon all along the south coast of England. Worried that they were losing valuable messages, the RAF ordered a massive cull. Over 600 adult birds and countless young hawks were killed during the war years. Given that there were only about 1,100 pairs in the entire country before the war, and that the cull was concentrated on the south coast, the action must have killed almost all of the birds in southern England. However, after the war, the numbers recovered surprisingly quickly. And in 1961, English pigeon fanciers claimed the peregrine falcon population was getting out of hand and that the bird should lose its protected status. The government commissioned the British Trust for Ornithology to conduct a survey on falcon numbers. And to everyone's surprise, they discovered that although numbers had recovered well from the wartime cull, they'd begun to fall dramatically in the mid-1950s. Other studies around the world showed the same rapid decline. Falcons, which had once been numerous, were now extinct in the vast forests of Eastern Europe and had completely disappeared from the eastern side of North America. Now, there's a bit of a chemistry lesson here, but stick with me. Tissue studies of dead birds and that of the adult or broken eggs that were now so common seem to indicate that pesticides had a role in the decline. DDT was the most important of these chemicals, and throughout the 50s, it was widely used all over the world. And since 1947, pigeon fanciers had dusted their birds with it to kill feather lice. Closer investigation revealed that the falcons had suffered a double blow from the pesticides. The newer, more powerful organochlorines, such as aldrin and deldrin, accumulated in the fat of the bird that the falcons ate, often reaching toxic levels that killed the predators outright. At the same time, DDE, a product of DDT breakdown, accumulated in the falcons and interfered with an enzyme that is important in the production of eggshells. The shells became so thin that they broke under the weight of the brooding mother. These discoveries led to the restriction in the use of these pesticides, and follow-up surveys found numbers almost back up to 1961 levels by 1971, and by 1981 they were up to 90% of pre-war levels. There's a long way to go for recovery, but it's widely accepted that the plight of the falcon could equally apply to humans, also at the top of the food chain, and equally vulnerable. And it was the peregrine and other raptors that gave the world a wake-up call and resulted in the birth of the Green Movement, which continues to this day. The peregrine, a bird which we nearly destroyed, and a bird which could yet be our saviour.
They are beautiful, handsome animals, it has to be said. A lot of good information in that, Mr. McElroy.
Well, kind of mixed bag this morning again, you know. Chemistry lesson at this time of the morning. It's a brave statement on out of doors, but you never know what you're going to get on this programme.
Yeah, absolutely. It holds true for us half the time as well. This email came
why
in
are we from, here?
what's going on? This came in from Judith Campbell. Says, I spent all my childhood holidays at a bay near North Berwick. Sometimes my father would wake me early in the morning saying, come on, it's a good day for the bass. I'd jump out of bed, we'd have some porridge and take his small blue boat with a seagull outboard motor out into the bay and head for the bass. Wow. I've never forgotten the smells, the sights and the sounds. Often we'd see seals as well and they were always very curious. Happy memories indeed. Thanks for that, Judith. That's a nice image, that.
Now, you've probably gathered, if you've been following the Outdoors Facebook page and things like that, that I walked the West Highland Way last week, as Ewan did. How many years ago was it now? 3 or 4 years?
Well, it was more than that, about 6 or 7, I think.
Never, was it? Time flies when you're enjoying yourself. Anyway, we're going to be bringing you more about that walk next week. But quick quiz question, Ewan. When you think of the West Highland Way, who immediately springs to mind?
I'm really envious of this because you got to speak to Jimmy McGregor and I didn't.
Yeah, Jimmy was the first person to draw attention to the West Highland Way and inspire interest from a wide audience when it was first established 40 years ago. He did a radio programme first and then there was this incredibly popular TV series. I managed to meet up with Jimmy recently. I used to work with him years ago. He's now 90 and as sharp as a tack, and I asked him to explain how the whole thing came about in the first place.
Coincidentally, my partner Robin Hall and I, who'd been a partnership for about 22, 23 years or something, and that came to an abrupt halt. And for the first time in my working life, I found myself in a kind of hiatus. And so I filled the time by doing a few wee solo gigs, but my heart was never in those, really, having been half of a duet for so long. And I put together a couple of wee collections of folk songs and got those published. And then, coincidentally, I read about the inauguration of the West Highland Way in October 1980, that was. And I thought, I'd been a hill walker since I was a boy, you know. And I thought, I'm going to walk that anyway. And having decided to walk it, I was living in Highgate at the time, and I've always basically fit, like yourself, and always kept basically fit. But I spent about 6 weeks jogging around Highgate Woods in heavy boots and all that stuff to just get myself keyed up to walk it. And on a whim, I phoned Radio Scotland in Glasgow and said, I'm going to walk this, and I know a wee bit about, I know a lot about the wildlife, a wee bit about the geology and the Rob Roy connection and the Duke of Montrose and all, you know, and even the Bonnie Prince. I know quite a lot about it, and I'm going to walk it anyway. Would you be interested? So it was Chris Irwin at the time was the head bummer, and Mike Shaw brought me up and had a talk about it, and they said, well, do you think there's a half-hour programme in it? And I said, oh. Anyway, they let me do it, and off I went with just a wee basic, you know, a wee pack. And I carried a wee pup tent, and a Akai recorder, was that what they were called, the wee miniature things. And I didn't realise how expensive they were, and I was banging nails in my boots and stuff. And then I discovered when I got back there about 4,000 quid or something. But anyway, I took off, and I really blethered to myself most of the way because there was hardly anybody there. I've made this kind of educated guess many times that when I walked, I probably encountered maybe 50, 60 people in the whole 95 miles. So you interviewed as many as you could, and most of them were duff and they just got wiped. There were a few good ones. The rest of it was just me talking, you know. So, I mean, the experience was terrific for me. I really loved it. I loved it. And that's how the thing got started.
Am I right in thinking it was one of the first long-distance routes in this country?
It was the first official marked walkway in Scotland, yeah. And, of course, it's led to so many more. That's the wonderful thing, especially, well, for everybody. But for me, it was a gift because I just did it because I wanted to do it. And the BBC actually employed me to do it, which was a bonus. And then it led on. I did this book here, you know, that I'm showing it as if we're on television. So I did the book, and I had a big struggle to get that published. Actually, BBC Books in London were not all that interested. And then it turned out to be quite a success. I had about 4 reprints, and it was the top of the Scottish booksellers list. And Willie McIlvany, who was a pal of mine, a real writer, came second. And I said to him, well, your mistake is you don't talk enough about beetles and buzzards and stuff like that, you know. But it was a bit of a joke. But so the book was fine, and that led to, that of course led to the television series. But the West Highland Way, once we had done that one, for radio, we followed up with the Southern Upland Way, which is a lot longer, as you know, the Speyside Way and the Cairngorms, McGregor across Scotland, blah, blah, blah. But just went on and on and on. So I did the Ulster Walkway. And then we did this huge one in Canada, which was from downtown Toronto all the way to Thunder Bay in Alaska. We drove, and then it was Yosemite with Anna Magnusson, and then the Arctic with Ron Spencer again. So that one wee idea that I had, I'm going to walk the West Highland Way, just took my whole... I hate talking about my career, it sounds so pompous. Took my work in another direction and opened a whole great sphere of activity for me, and also stuff that I really love doing, you know.
I always admire people who talk about careers because, you know, I haven't really had a career. It's just been one happy accident after another, but they've all been accidents.
That's exactly right, yeah. I've planned very little, you know. I mean, I sometimes have wee notions that lead to other things, but I'm not a planner, not by any means. I never will be.
Superb Jimmy McGregor there. And we're planning on publishing that full interview as a Scotland Outdoors podcast very soon. We'll keep you posted. In the meantime, you'll be able to download the first section of my West Highland Way adventure on Wednesday at midday. Look out for that on BBC Sounds or in the podcast section of the BBC Radio Scotland website. And if you're not a podcast downloader, tune in to Out of Doors next Saturday to hear the first half of my journey celebrating 40 years of the West Highland Way. It is a remarkable route, though, isn't it?
It is fantastic, but listening to Jimmy is just brilliant. Jimmy, I know you worked as a researcher on the Jimmy McGregor programme. I remember vividly lying in my bed on a North Sea oil rig, writing an application form to be a researcher in the BBC. It was the first ever BBC application I'd ever filled in. I was so excited about. Of course, obviously, they didn't get the job, but it kind of sowed the seed of, you know, he's out there, he's enjoying it, he's in the countryside. Yeah. And, you know, we're lucky enough to be following his footsteps to a certain extent, if that doesn't sound pompous.
No, absolutely. And to be honest, there have been many sadnesses with, you know, COVID-19 and the lockdown and what have you. One of the hardest things I found there was actually leaving Jimmy's house and not being able to shake his hand, you know, because I really, really wanted to. There's some comments here from... go on, I know you go.
Yeah, go on.
You just say...
No, you carry on, that's more important.
Yeah, much more important. Potato Doctor says, we're in Argyll. Something was at the window last night. Pine Martin, maybe? How am I supposed to know? Billy Austin...
It was a Pine Martin.
Was a pine, definitely. Billy Austin says, awful one day, beautiful the next, awful the following day. Great British weather. I'm glad he's not talking about the programme. And finally, Mary Sutherland from Perth says, what a wonderful programme this morning. North Berwick was supposed to be my holiday destination this year. However, I was unable to go. Thank you for taking me there virtually. It's been our pleasure, Mary. That's it for this week. From everyone here, thanks for listening.